All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Younger listeners might know John Battelle as being one of the original forces behind the Web 2.0 movement in the early 2000s, as the founder of the Web 2.0 Summit, as well as Federated Media. But John was also the founding editor of both Wired Magazine and Industry Standard Magazine, that great lost magazine of record for the dot-com era. For our purposes here, we've been spending a lot of time focusing on Hotwired, so that's why I was super excited to speak with John and get some of the background stories from the mothership, from Wired the magazine. Again, I think this is another excellent discussion, so please enjoy John Battelle. John Battelle, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
I'm very happy to be here.
So when I was doing a little research on you, I was surprised to find out that you kind of got your start in journalism at Mac Week. Is that correct?
That is correct. I took a job there. Well, I should say I took an unpaid internship there when I graduated from college.
So what was the Apple Media Industrial Complex like in the days before blogs and things?
Well, it was quite similar in terms of the way they handled the press. I was I guess you could say, an unabashed Macintosh fanboy. I guess the Mac was only 3 years old at that point, but it came out while I was in college, and I did a little bit of kind of QA user testing work on a database application that was built both for the PC and the Mac while I was in college as a you know, side job. And I just fell in love with the Mac and thought it was just the most important thing that had happened in the history of forever in terms of our cultural artifacts. I was studying cultural anthropology at Berkeley, and it seemed to be, you know, the most exciting, interesting, new, you know, kind of instantiation of you know, something that we had built as a culture that was going to, you know, be remembered for a very long time as fundamental and world changing. So I just wanted to be involved in it. And when I graduated, I had a couple of opportunities. One of them was this unpaid internship at a startup magazine that was covering the Macintosh, and the other one was I was pursuing a technology analyst job because I wanted to be in that space of looking at the impact of technology at Morgan Stanley. And the Morgan Stanley job, everyone told me, was just a grind, and everyone who had analyst jobs at investment banks were super unhappy, and I just didn't like the idea of going to a big skyscraper and, you know, being stuck in a cube. So I went for the unpaid internship, which it's kind of funny because it's about the same time that Mary Meeker started her career. And Mary, of course, became a you know, world famous technology analyst from Morgan Stanley. But I'm very happy with my choice because it turned into a paying job, I think, like a week or two later. And then 3 years of just super happy work being a reporter covering the space.
So how does that lead to, being a reporter to being, you know, the managing editor of Wired? Was it something that you applied for? Had you encountered Lewis and Jane prior to that?
Only very, very briefly. So while I was a reporter, I mean, as it now happens with, you know, sort of hot shot reporters at TechCrunch or Mashable or, you know, the New York Times or wherever, you kind of get a reputation. I was known as a sort of a scoop machine, and I think I got a pretty good reputation for really deeply, you know, caring about understanding what I was covering. I did my share of rewriting press releases. Everyone does that when you're starting out, but I really wanted to understand the larger impacts of the things I was covering, and I covered databases and networking, and I covered user interface and certain beats throughout those few years. But I also rapidly kind of turned into a manager. I became, like, I think, an assistant managing editor at MacWeek, and I ran the copy desk, which is the group of people who process all the stories and put them into the word processing program. I got extremely proficient with the software that we used to make the magazine. It was the first national desktop published magazine ever. And so I just made a lot of contacts, and I became kind of known in that, at the time, a very small industry. And then I left to go to graduate school because I really wanted to tell the story more broadly. I thought that there was a huge story that was not being told about the impact of technology on our culture. And at MacWeek, it was a, you know, business-to-business vertical that, you know, wrote for corporate IT managers who were responsible for purchasing computers, right? And so you write to that audience very differently than you might write to
consumer,
who eventually became the readers of Wired, right?
Right.
And so when I went to graduate school, you know, kind of my world opened up, the aperture opened up quite significantly. And while I was there, I developed an idea to start a magazine about that story. Essentially, I came up with the idea for something that looked and felt like Wired, but I didn't have the chops. I didn't have the business chops. I didn't have the design chops. I didn't really know what I was doing. And fortunately, one of my colleagues at MacWeek, who went on to do other things, had run into Lewis and Jane and talked to them about becoming the managing editor, but he just didn't think it was a good fit, or he didn't want to take the risk of, you know, this underfunded startup. He was older, and I think, you know, he just had more responsibilities and a little less risk tolerance. So he suggested that they talk to me. And Lewis gave me a call in the summer of 92, right when I had just graduated and was finishing up a internship at the Los Angeles Times, which I really did not enjoy because it's a big corporate environment, and I don't do well in those kinds of environments. At least I didn't then. And when Lewis called and described his idea to me, I was like, holy crap, I'll show you my thesis, a master's thesis proposal, which I had created to create a magazine that sounded exactly like the same thing. That master's thesis proposal was shot down by my dean. He said, there's no way you're going to be able to pull this off. He was probably right. And I ended up writing a long 10,000-word piece on the future of print as it relates to interactivity. But I think the fact that I had, you know, already come up with a similar idea and was super passionate about it, and Lewis and I just clicked, and he took a big flyer on me because I was 26 years old and really had no justification for being the managing editor of that magazine. But he took a flyer on me, and it ended up working out pretty well.
So when you join on, what stage are they at? Are they still raising money, or they have enough money to start the prototype first episode issue?
Yeah.
Is that where they're at?
They had raised a little bit of seed money, and they had built a, you know, like a hand-built prototype of what it might look like. And there were four or five full-time people, Lewis, Jane, Kevin Kelly, John Plunkett, and his wife, who were the designers, and a couple of people who were kind of working either part-time or for no money, who were just kind of connected to it through, you know, to do distribution or you know, production or whatever. But there wasn't really a staff beyond the founders. So I kind of came in as the fifth founder, I think. And so it was, you know, my job was from the time I started in August to the time we shipped the first magazine, which was in December, which was essentially to build issue one.
Mm-hmm. And it launches around the Macworld in January of 93, is that right?
Yep. We shipped it in late December, and we got bound copies back like on day one or two of Macworld.
And how quickly, you know, this is one of those things that I like to ask, you know, directly, because the legend is that, you know, the magazine was an instantaneous overnight success. How quickly do you remember it being successful and taking off?
It depends on how you define success. If you define success by, you know, how your core market that you really were writing for responded to it, it was an overnight instantaneous success. There's a couple ways you can tell that. One is just talking to people, right? You know, when we were handing out the issues, and that's what we did, we took boxes of the, you know, straight from the printer, and we went out to Macworld, and I'm, you know, stood at the bottom of escalators when people were getting off from Moscone and handed them issues, you know. And then you'd get reader feedback. You know, you talk to people later that day or, you know, at night during the parties or whatever, and people loved it. You know, people said it was amazing. It blew their minds. That, you know, they'd been thinking the same thing. It was like something appeared in the world that catalyzed a conversation that was already happening. So from that perspective, it was clearly, you know, a hit almost immediately. The next thing we noticed is, you know, when you launch a magazine, you put little cards in it. There, if you recall, if you ever did, you used to read magazines.
Right, yeah.
You open them up, the cards would fall out in your lap and right. Irritate the hell out of you. That's called white mail. If people actually fill that out and send it back, you know, that's like a huge win because that means you spent no money to acquire a new subscriber. Our white mail was overwhelming. We started getting these cards back in the mail at a level way, way higher than we expected. And, you know, we had a new staff that we had put together. You know, I remember people in the offices, five or six people would just sit around with the next issue, which was 2 months later, and mailing them out individually because we didn't have a fulfillment process because we did not expect, I can't remember the numbers, but they were, I don't know, 5 or 10,000, maybe more. That came in from the first issue, which was insane. That's like way higher than you might expect. And that's when we knew we had a bona fide hit on our hands because, you know, that kind of response is pretty unheard of.
So that let's just take that first year then after the launch, you know, so let's say the first 10 or 12 issues that you put out. What are the stories that you're pursuing? Like what do you feel like the vision, the mission was that the magazine was going to try to tackle?
Well, we wanted to tell the stories of how technology was changing our culture. You know, on the one hand, my sort of formal journalism training and my instinct was to go report those stories and find them wherever they were and tell them. But the truth is that many of them were not yet truly unfolding and required a certain amount of taking a sort of kernel of a story and playing it forward and imagining what was going to happen because of it, as opposed to what was actually happening. So we really believed that the way education was going to be structured and pursued was going to change fundamentally because of digital technology and networking. But, you know, to to go find a proof point of that was really hard because it just wasn't happening. You know, the idea of even just computers in schools was pretty new. And what computers were in schools were, like, you know, a bunch of IBM PCs kind of, you know, teaching kids how to program Pascal, right? Or, you know, maybe some technical schools teaching kids how to become IT managers, right? There really was not, I mean, where we are now with, I don't know, public companies that are, you know, MOOCs or, you know, 2U, which is a public company that does education platforms and so on. That was all, like, in our imagination that was going to have a story, right? And that happened in almost every field of endeavor. I mean, anywhere we looked, we saw the story, but it was super hard to actually find that story and tell it in a meaningful way without really using your imagination.
So in a way, what you're saying is it's a little bit reporting, but then there's a lot of extrapolating that you have to do also.
There's reporting, there's extrapolation, there's going and finding, you know, edge fringe cultures that may be harbingers of where the story was going to end up going. So, like, in the first issue, you know, we went out and talked to all the freelance writers we could who kind of had done anything interesting in this space. And there were, you know, I would say a handful of them, right? You know, whereas if you were doing Rolling Stone, you could find a rock and roll writer anywhere. But you're doing the Rolling Stone of technology, you know, it's like, okay, where are the people who, you know, I felt like were like me, you know, who wanted to just tell this story and that's all they cared about and they just were so stoked about it. And, you know, we found John Markoff at the New York Times, or we found, you know, a guy who lived in Japan and was noticing this sort of crazy culture around Japanese anime, you know, and we asked them to either, you know, not just write about that culture in Japan, but pull back and say, what does this mean if this kind of culture spreads around the world, you know? And it was that perspective, that sort of optimism about how this thing was going to spread beyond what it is now, that I think really helped inform the magazine. You know, we would say, we would use a lot of the quotes that are now kind of, you know, givens in our industry, but we were really, like, surfacing them often for the first time. You know, we would talk about McLuhan. We would talk about Vannevar Bush. You know, we would talk about, Gibson and, you know, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. So our job was to go find where it was and report that little glimmering of it and talk about what happens if that becomes the whole future, right? And so we were really driven to find those stories that, you know, seemed unimportant but turned out to be super important.
So do you remember when, obviously the story eventually is going to become that the revolution is happening and it's happening on the web and the internet, which obviously existed when Wired launched but weren't really a thing yet, mainstream-wise.
Yeah.
Do you remember when that started to change and then that is becoming the more prominent story?
Sure. In the first issue, one of the people who we were just connected to as a writer who was paying attention to this stuff is a guy named John Browning, who was in Europe at the time at The Economist. And in an email thread, maybe it was Lewis or Kevin or me, I don't know who he was talking to, but he said, hey, you know, there's this kind of really interesting project at the sort of European equivalent of Los Alamos Labs called CERN, and it's done by this guy, and it's called the World Wide Web, and we were fans of Ted Nelson and the Xanadu Project and, you know, his hyperlinking theories and all of that, and having been, you know, at Mac Week and covering HyperCard and all the, you know, potential behind that that kind of connectivity and content, we said, oh, there's probably something there. We did a brief mention of it, I think, in issue one, but by issue two, it was like, okay, this is a big deal, you know, and so it started becoming something that we paid attention to more, and by the middle of 93, you know, Mosaic had started, and we got the first, you know, we were like, all of us had, you know, the first version of Mosaic. We were all on the web all the time because all of us were already, you know, I was on like 6 different online services, you know, the Well, AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy. I was on all of them. And so when the web showed up and the potential to do what we were doing on the web became real, we were like, this is a huge deal. We have to figure out a way to do this. And this really, I all credit to Lewis because he was like on fire about doing this. And not only doing it, you know, like just putting our stories online, but making an entirely new medium out of it and figuring out a way to tell the story we're telling, but telling it natively to that medium was his battle cry.
Right. That actually, we're getting into hotwired territory now. That actually strikes me too, because, you know, famously, Lewis and Jane had such a hard time raising money for Wired. Wired, the magazine, finally comes out and is successful. And then immediately on top of this, it's almost like, okay, now we have to launch an entirely new thing. You know, there's no time to rest on our laurels or enjoy the success or anything.
No, none. I mean, we you know, we spent a lot of time in our kind of senior management meetings, I guess you'd call it, though I don't think we would have called it that back then. But, you know, the five of us, you know, really thinking about how do we do this? You know, okay, we're making a magazine, we're going to keep making a magazine, but how do we create something new? You know, do we use the same editors? Do we use the same freelancers, the same content? Do we, you know, use the same, you know, people? And the answer in all those was no. We have an entirely focused, separate team that does nothing but this. And, you know, it was up to Lewis and Jane to figure out how to raise money to make that possible. But we really, from the very beginning, you know, we brought on an executive to run it, and that person was responsible for making a team and making the product. And, you know, what we did is we supported it. You know, the people who created the magazine supported it, and it was a division of the company we started, but we weren't, like, we didn't operationally run it day to day. We spent a lot of time on it, of course, but we didn't. It wasn't ours, you know, day to day. It was Andrew's and his team's.
Right. I spoke to Andrew 2 weeks ago. But was there any sort of bringing people over from the magazine side to the Hotwired side? Like people that, okay, if you're interested in this project, you can shift over, right?
I mean, to the extent that I don't want to misrepresent anything because I may just be forgetting stuff, but the truth is not really. That I recall, you know, most of us care deeply about that and we're very involved in it, you know, looking at features and products and helping, you know, if there's, you know, they hired a bunch of writers, they hired a bunch of designers and coders and, you know, support people. But we did not, I mean, we were so lean and so small at the time we made the decision to do this that it was not like, there was anyone to spare off the magazine, you know?
Right.
So we, you know, we just figured out how to, you know, what would be the Wired brand as it related to the internet and Hotwired, and what would be the Hotwired brand. And as I recall, I may be wrong here, I think Wired magazine was just a channel on Hotwired. Mm-hmm. We weren't, you know, some master brand over it.
So, what year is it that you finally leave Wired?
I left Wired in the summer, late summer, I think, of 97.
97. Okay, so that's not quite into the dot-com madness yet. You get to go through
all
that.
Well, it was certainly starting to happen. I mean, the Netscape IPO had already occurred, and
right.
There was an awful lot of madness and noise, and the mainstream media had already kind of caught up to the story and was putting the internet and the World Wide Web on every magazine cover and all the news, you know, coverage around, you know, was all whiz-bang and information superhighway and all that shit. And Wired itself was sort of the poster child of that story.
Right. Well, that's my question is, so as that starts to ramp up and it becomes this phenomenon, you know, and the internet is permeating, you know, all of media and mainstream stuff, is it harder for a monthly magazine to even, I know that you guys weren't like a news periodical, so you weren't covering stories, but was it harder to keep up as this cycle starts to spin faster and faster?
It really wasn't. You know, what we did was develop and execute super unique, you know, narrative, and there was so much of it, just so much of it, that it was not, it was never like, what are we going to put in the magazine this month? It was never, oh my God, someone else has beaten us to the punch. We watched as other magazines started to cover the same story, but they didn't have the depth of editorial understanding and the network of writers and illustrators and just creative folks involved. We always thought we were kind of owning that story, and I think we were owning that story when I left. And I didn't leave because I thought the magazine was on the wane or anything. I left because I was excited about doing something new
right.
that I thought I was uniquely kind of in the right position to do, not because I thought that that Monthly Magazine as a model was threatened. The company, you know, was... the company had its own issues that were, you know, unique to that company, but not unique to many startups that were trying to figure out the right way to finance and the right way to grow and the right way to manage people and all that stuff. But, you know, and that wasn't really even the reason I left. I mean, it might have been an informing reason because I was young and, you know, frustrated that I thought I had a great idea I wanted to do and I couldn't do it inside that company. But really the reason I left was I came up with an idea I thought was pretty good and I wanted to go do it.
Right. Before I ask you about industry standard, were you involved in any of the other projects like the launch of Hotbot or anything like that?
I was involved in all of them insofar as we made decisions about do we do this or do we not do this or how do we do this or who do we hire or can you interview people and that kind of stuff. Some of them I was more involved in than others. I was not very involved in Hotbot at all. That turned out to be a very, very smart move by Andrew and others. I was, you know, moderately involved in that I would spend a lot of time during kind of pre-launch and launch in a number of other projects, whether they were launching in other countries like the UK or launching a book series, which we launched, called Hardwired, or launching a television unit, which I worked on a lot for a while, Wired TV. So I got involved in a lot of different things. But I, you know, Hotwired at the time I had left was its own big entity doing its own thing. And I wasn't very involved in a lot of the strategic stuff that they did, like Hotbot.
So you do leave Wired to start Industry Standard, right? Is it your idea to start the magazine, or were you recruited for that?
No. I had the idea, and I brought it to, you know, to Lewis and Kevin, and you know, those two guys. You know, no idea is going to happen without the editorial troika, which was the three of us agreeing that it was going to happen. And you know, Lewis thought it was a good idea, but he just didn't. He wasn't excited about it, and I understand why. You know, probably for a number of reasons, one of which is kind of expensive to start a weekly magazine. And so I was, you know, I was actually just trying to figure out what I was going to do with this idea because I was, you know, super hot to do it. And while I was doing it, and it's sort of similar to how I ended up at Wired, I got a phone call from a recruiter from a company that wanted to start a magazine covering the internet, a weekly magazine covering the internet. And so they didn't have an editorial point of view about what it was or, you know, how it was going to approach the market or any of that stuff. But they just, you know, it was IDG and they saw a new market emerging and they wanted to have an entrant in that market. So I became the guy they hired to make that happen. It was a, you know, and I showed the guy who ran IDG, I showed him, here's my plan, here's what I think we can do. And he's like, okay, go do it.
So just to briefly touch on it, what was it like to be running a weekly magazine on the internet, you know, in the midst of the dot-com madness in 98, 99, that time period?
First of all, I don't know how much I remember. I mean, I was literally a blur. People think the industry standard was an overnight success too, and by the standards of publishing it was, but we had a couple lean years, maybe a year and a half where it was like we didn't know if it was going to work. Everyone loved the editorial product. We had an absolute hardcore readership. They loved the product. And so that piece was, I think we nailed it. But it was hard to find an advertiser base in late 97, 98, and even early 99, because, the big companies with the big budgets had not yet decided that this market was important for them. And so that's where I was working my tail off with Cisco and IBM and HP and, all those guys just saying, hey, this market's really important and these readers are really important and here's why they're different and special and here's why reaching them in the industry standard as opposed to Business Week or as opposed to the Wall Street Journal is more important contextually. They're reading for this very purpose and you want to be part of this story. So it was hard. But the other piece was I launched not just a magazine. I learned from Wired and I launched a very sophisticated online site for the time that we launched it that got a lot of traffic. And I launched conferences at the same time so that we had three lines of revenue from the very beginning. I couldn't have done that really without the support of a corporate parent like IDG who, had a conference group who could execute conferences. And, so we took advantage of that. But it was not easy. On the other hand, when the standard sort of became, the Bible of the first dot-com boom, we had a whole other set of problems, which was that all of a sudden everyone wanted to advertise. I mean, the bit just flipped, I think, in, spring of 99. And what happened was is that everybody, everyone's startup started getting funded. All those startups wanted to advertise what they were about and their, who they were and why they mattered. And they all wanted to buy pages in the industry standard because they understood that that market was kind of feeding on itself, that everybody read that magazine and that if they were in that magazine, then they mattered. And then it was just like, managing a hyper growth company. I felt like I was holding on to the back of a truck going 100 miles an hour.
So industry standard famously did not survive the dot-com bust, but
right.
I've seen an interview where you said that led you to sort of have a crisis of faith about the whole narrative of technology and innovation and things like that. Was it literally Google that got you your faith back in terms of technology and innovation?
I would say it was search. Now Google was the most robust exemplar of search. But it was really search. When everything blew up in 2001, it really started blowing up in mid-2000, but no one noticed because there was so much money washing around that it took another 6 to 9 months for it to really wash out. But when it was amply evident by the first to second quarter of 2001 that we were going to have to be refinanced or we were going to have to stop the magazine and stop the whole enterprise. And it wasn't just us. I mean, there's, I don't know how much market value was lost during that period of time, but it was historic, right? It was a far bigger story than just us. And it seemed like the whole world lost faith in the internet and sort of felt like, well, we got conned. We were told this was going to be the biggest thing in the world. But it turns out it's just another thing, It's going to be around, of course. We're not going to, disassemble the internet and go home. But it's not that big a deal anymore, And that's what everybody said. That's what all the advertisers said, And I'm not talking about the advertisers like the dot-com companies. All that money went away. But the real guys, the IBMs and the Apples and the HPs of the world, they're like, yeah, we're just going to go back to the Wall Street Journal, right? And the story got super depressing, And I follow narrative. I follow stories. And the story really got depressing. Everyone was out of work. You know, San Francisco was a ghost town. I remember going into work at San Francisco in early 2001, and there's nobody in the streets. You know, I mean, it was really, really unhappy. And yeah, I kind of lost faith with the story. And I think the truth is, for 3 or 4 years there, while I was trying to figure out what it means to be a CEO and run a growth company and just, you know, hire people fast enough for the opportunity, I was not in the story. I was not reporting. I was not, you know, what I was doing at Wired, except for the last year and a half, where I ran business development and, you know, expansion into different businesses, I lost touch with the core narrative. But at Wired, I was every single word in that magazine I edited. You know, I wrote almost all of the, you know, big type, you know, the headlines, the pull quotes, the captions, all that. I talked with writers all day long about their story and helped them revise it, redraft them, and restructure them. I wrote a column every month that ran through the magazine. I was deep in the narrative. I talked to sources all the time, you know, so I really felt like I understood the narrative, right? But at the Standard, I made a very, very important decision, and I don't know whether it was the right one or not, but I made a very important decision, which was I was not going to be the editor-in-chief. So I hired an editor-in-chief, and I did not meddle with him. I did not fuck with him. I didn't tell him what to do. I gave him an editorial blueprint that I had written for the magazine. I said, "Do you agree with this?" He said, "It's awesome." I said, "Take it. Let's go make a magazine." And I did everything but editorial. So I kind of lost track of the story. And when, you know, the kind of music ended and there wasn't a seat to sit down in, right? And I was like wandering in empty streets. I didn't know what the story was. And so I started to kind of look around and say, well, what's going on? And where I saw signs of true life in the narrative was down in Pasadena at Overture and in Mountain View at Google. I mean, here were two companies that felt like it was 1998 and it was never not going to be 1998. You know, it's like they hadn't noticed that the dot-com boom happened, right? Like, I'm like, what happened? Why are these guys thriving when everyone else is wiped out? And as I dug deeper into that, and I really went deep, you know, I just realized that the story is way bigger than I thought. And that, in fact, you know, the whole dot-com bust was sort of part of a process that we were going through as an economy in transition to becoming a true information economy. And that these two companies and a number of companies that were, you know, in the ecosystem around those companies or competing with them in some way, that was the first sign of the next advance of where the story was going to go. And for me, that gave me incredible sense of passion about I wasn't wrong. This story is as big as I thought it was when we started Wired or when I went to Mac Week. And I need to go tell this story, which is how I ended up starting SearchBlog and then writing the search and coming up with the business idea behind Federated.
Right.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, hopefully I'll be able to talk to you again in the future when I get to the Web 2.0 stuff and we can discuss all that.
And then Web 2 came from that. You know, also. I mean, I started all three or four of those things at the very same year, 2003 to 2004.
Well, as my last question, as I always say, everyone I'm talking to, a lot of the stuff we're talking about is exactly 20 years ago. So my final question is always, when you look at the web, the internet, technology in general today, is it what you thought it would be 20 years ago? Has it not quite lived up to what you hoped it would be 20 years ago? Where do you think we are right now?
Parts of it have vastly overshot where I thought that we'd be. In other words, like, we're way ahead. I wouldn't have thought that information flows would have reorganized energy and matter to the point where, you know, the entire transportation, hospitality industries are literally being rethought because of, you know, startups like, you know, Uber or Airbnb, or that those are probably two of the best examples. But in other areas, I'm stunned at how little progress we've made, like almost none. I would have thought in healthcare and energy and in
education,
financial services and education, we would have been far, far further along. I kind of feel like we are where I would have expected us to be when it comes to how many people are online and how we express ourselves, right? So the whole social media thing did not come as a surprise to me. It struck me as completely what we would have expected it to be, that everyone lived online and had their own sense of who they were online. That strikes me as completely normal. I would have not thought that we would have been as far behind as we are on bandwidth. You know, it's a sort of appalling that, you know, it took us 20 years to go from dial-up to, you know, a thin pipe. Mm-hmm. You know, where we're fighting, you know, between family members as to who's streaming Netflix, right? Like, that's silly that we have that problem. I would not have imagined. Someone said, 20 years from now, do you think this will be a problem? I go, no. One thing we know we can do is we can scale fucking processors and we can scale bandwidth, right? And we didn't. We're doing a pretty good job, but we're not where I thought we'd be. But, you know, I mean, generally speaking, it all kind of feels like it all happened. You know, all the things that we were, I often say about Wired that what we did is we declared a really important story that many people were not paying attention to. And the way we declared it is we got into the middle of the public square and, you know, yelled and screamed and stamped our feet and wore wildly crazy fluorescent colors, you know, just said, hey, pay attention to this. It's a huge deal. And you know what? People did. And it's not just because of us. Of course not. But, you know, I think we had a big voice in it. And I think, you know, the story has now become super mainstream. And it's still the most exciting and relatively untapped story that we have, I think, in the world. I think we're just at the very, very early stages of it. I mean, we're, what, 20, 25 years into it? And, you know, the kind of shifts we're going through right now, these are 1,000-year shifts. And that's what we were arguing back then. And I think, you know, now we can argue that and not be laughed at. and everyone would generally agree. So the question is, we have much harder work to do now. How do we do this? What decisions do we make? You know, this is now at the top of mind of every major head of state, every, you know, major policymaker, every major head of a corporation, every, you know, major head of a university. This is the central conversation that's happening. 20 years ago, we were demanding a seat at the table just to tell the story. Now everyone is part of it and they all know it. And I think that's amazing progress in 20 years.
John Battelle, thank you for remembering all that for us.
Yeah. Happy to. Thank you for the opportunity.
If you're enjoying this podcast, there's one simple thing that you can do to help us out. If you do nothing else, just go to iTunes and rate us. 1 to 5 stars takes about 2 seconds. Or give us a review, because the weird way that iTunes works is it's not just the number of downloads, it's also the number of ratings and reviews. As always, you can join the conversation at www.internethistorypodcast.com. Get more info, see pictures, and see my full bibliography for each episode. The show's Twitter is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.